a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3460 of the Survival Podcast. Today we're going to be continuing a series that we started a couple weeks ago on redefining education. In that first episode, I spent a good 30 to 40 minutes at the beginning explaining the problem. We won't be doing that today. We're going to pretty much jump straight in to things that we can learn ourselves or teach children or learn together that we should know by the time the state gets done taking 13 years of our lives from us, but most people can't do. And I will say most people, and I'm going to say that this audience is probably not most people, right? The skill sets within this audience are far beyond what I guess you would call as typical in the world. But we're going to be talking mainly about life skills today. And 10 skills, in fact, that we should be teaching people. And what's funny is there was one that didn't make it because it'll go on the part three of this series. And my wife's literally doing it with my grandson right now. When I went to get my coffee cup filled up, if I had had the time, I would have swapped it just because it was actually happening. But I'll tell you about it in part three. So we're going to dig into that. But I'm also going to lead off today with three. Count them. One, two, three. Blah, ha, ha. Remember when TV was actually educational? Remember when Oscar the Grouch and all them, who was the count? Taught us how to do like counting instead of use pronouns like back then. Whoa, right. We're gonna try to restore some of that today. But I really want to kind of make an impact on you today. If there is any way that you can add this to your life and to the lives of children around you. And while it is coming at an angle of education for kids, because this is where the biggest problems are. And we do the majority of our learning between the time, you know, from we get to the point where we can crawl around and stick things in our mouth up till about our mid 20s. That's just how humans are. We learn more in that period of time than we do probably for the rest of our lives, unless we are dedicated to learning. And like, unless it's something that's like really important to us and we're in some sort of position or skill set where you have to keep learning to keep up. And then usually they only learn their kind of thing in their box. So we're going to be talking about changing that today for the better and doing it by redefining what an education actually should be. Because I have to say, when I think back to being in school, there was a lot wrong with school when I was a kid. But today, there's a lot more wrong. There's a lot more wrong, and I'm not just talking about the woke bullshit. I'm talking about just how much has been stripped away from what kids learn in school. I could do 20 of these shows, and I could probably stick to things I did learn in school that you can't anymore, though I might have to really start breaking skills down and go to 20, right? If I had to be 200 things, but, you know, I had metal shop in school. I had wood shop in school. I had accounting classes in high school. I learned a lot of things in school that I grew up most of my life assuming that everybody else did too. And I've been amazed at how many people my age and certainly as you move younger, like down to like 30, don't know how to do a lot of things that I just thought everybody knew how to do. So we're going to talk about having to change that today or how we can change it. Before we do, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is Start9 Embassy Servers. And I'm just going to play their home screen video for you so I don't have to talk about them because they can tell you all about themselves.
We all save our data, but where is it saved? In the cloud, which is actually this building in one of these computers with millions of others. This is called a honeypot, a single place full of data worth a hacker's time to steal. But instead, if you saved your data on your own computer at home, you wouldn't be worth the attack. Saving your own data is easy. Simply plug in a Start9 device and start saving all your own data today. So, will you stay in the honeypot? Or will you take control of your data? Start now. Start9.
All right, guys. I'm just going to say, out of the gate with this one, getting a Start9 embassy server, installing it in your home, and learning together with your kids how to use it, that might be a really great one to add to today. I'll just leave it at that. Next up today, let's talk about someplace that I'm going to be in just a couple months. Exit and Build 24. Now, it's not the 24th. It's the year 24, so I'm calling it that. John's just calling it Exit and Build Land Summit number 4. And if you want to come meet some amazing people, me, Joel Salatin, Nicole Sauce, Matt Powers, of course, John Bush, and a ton of other great people, you should come on down to Exit and Build. It is an awesome event. It's going to be May 17, 18, and 19. That's the weekend. But also on the 16th and sometime thereafter, I don't remember what the dates are exactly. It might be the 25th, 16th and 20th. They're doing some farm tours. Those are extra, and you have to pay for them, but it's not a lot of money. And I really encourage you, if you're going to come to Exit and Build in person, which is the best way to do it if you can, really think about upgrading to the higher level ticket. Now, I do not have an affiliate relationship with Johnny. He's a straight up sponsor. I don't make any more money if you do that. So I'm not incentivized in any way to suggest that upgrade. What I can tell you, though, is it's worth it. You know, some of the people that I got to meet, because as a speaker, I'm automatically upgraded to that stuff, like the dinner, you know, that's usually, I think Saturday night is usually the big dinner. Just the people I met alone were worth the upgrade, even if I had to pay for it myself. And then there's just some really awesome stuff. And let me say something else about this real quick. If you can come in person, I would try to bolt in some extra time. Bastrop's actually a really cool little town, not far from Austin. So if you want to go into the city, you can do that. But Bastrop's got like everything you need. And you have to hit me up privately if you want me to give away the best place to eat in Bastrop. I don't want to put it on the air. I don't want to end up with so many people there. I get roped out of whatever dinner I plan there myself while I'm there. But it's pretty flipping awesome. Last time I was at Exit and Build, I took Ken Berry to dinner there. Or that was the time before. And the last time I was there, I took my buddy David and Nicole Sauce. We went there. And it was freaking awesome. Anyway, let's get into this. Let's start talking about redefining education. But I wanted to lead off with three quotes for you. The first one is by Stafford Beer. And this is a very famous quote. You've definitely heard it on this show before. You will definitely hear it again because it is so poignant. It is so dead spot on to the reality that we face. And that is, the purpose of a system is what it does, not what it claims to do. So the education system claims to do a lot of things, or claims to try to do a lot of things. But what it does is it produces children into young adults who are permanently left as adult adolescents if something doesn't change in their life, who are complacent and compliant with authority. That's what it produces. I don't care what it's supposed to do. I don't care how hard the teacher that you love in your life, or the teacher that you are, or the teacher that you're married to tries. I don't care. The purpose of the system is what the system does. And I'm not coming down on teachers at all in this series. I'm not. Because it's a system, and you could take 20 of the best teachers known on the planet, put them all in one large public school, and they would change very little about that school. They might have children that are more motivated and excited and things like that. That would be great. But the overall results would be the same, because it's a system, not a person. It's not about people. You could put people into a system, and you can have them build a weapon that can destroy the planet, and they will all do their jobs. Exactly. And they'll all be good at them. And they'll all mean well. But boom, now the planet's gone. So it doesn't matter. The system is doing what it's supposed to do, or it wouldn't do it. The next one is, and this is by Buckminster Fuller, you never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. That's what those of us doing homeschooling, that is what we are doing, in fact. We are obsoleting the current system that is a state hegemony, right? Using coercion and force with a peaceful system that does a better job of what the system says it's supposed to do versus what the system does. So we have got to do this because no one will do it for us. That's kind of the upshot of that. You can't change the current system because nobody that actually has the power to change it wants to. Plenty of people in it
want to change it and make it better. It doesn't matter. They don't have the power. The people that have the power are the governments and the backdoor lobbyists that control the elected officials. And they have no interest in changing a system that's worked as well as it has for them for 150 freaking years. So if you want it to change, you have to obsolete it. Okay, we are going to have to basically starve it. It is a parasite. Now, when you think about how parasites function, so if you had a tick on you, it's sucking your blood. If you wouldn't need to poison it. All you would need to do is if you could put something on it that it made it incapable of getting your blood, it will fall off, go away, and look for something else because it can't feed on its host anymore. So you have to deny parasites the host to kill them. And we do that by replacing a system. This is also very similar to David Holmgren's comments about permaculture. David Holmgren said that we stopped fighting what we didn't want and started building the world we did want. We have to do that with education. I'm sorry. We have to. There is no fixing this. And the last thing, and I mean this to be an encouragement for those of you that are afraid to homeschool, I also mean it to be cautionary as to what it takes to actually get a child into learning. And it's a big part of why the system won't work. And it's by a name you guys probably know. Used to be on the expert council before they started traveling all across the country and decided they didn't have time to serve that way for us anymore. But Michael and Sue LaPrise. But this was specifically something Sue LaPrise said to my wife when we were making the decision, can we really do this? She said, you can't get a child to learn a thing they refuse to learn, nor prevent them from learning a thing they want to know. See, the system that you have cannot be tailored to any individual. It has to be one size fits all. Even if everybody was well-intentioned that was part of it, and they're not, but even if they were, you still can't do that. You can't tailor the motivation to the individual. All you can say is you're in trouble if you don't get at least a B or a C, or you better do your homework, or I'll send a nasty gram home to mommy. That's all you can do in that system, and you have to teach a specific curriculum the way that you're told to do it, right? And that means you're going to have a shitload of kids that aren't going to learn diddly fuck all. Because if they do not want to learn it, you can't make them. You can't make them. But what should empower you as a homeschooler is once they want to learn a thing, you can't prevent them from learning it either. Now, this is kind of the military commander mindset that you need to work with here to understand this. There's the old story. I'm sure it actually has some basis in fact and reality. But, you know, it's the confidence course, and the soldier climbs up to the top of the tower. And he has to walk across his beam. It's like 80 feet in the air. And we did this when I was in the Army. It was I can't remember what it was called now, something tower in Fort Jackson, right? But you had to walk across this beam. And there's a net under you. It'll catch you. It's still scary as shit if you've never done anything like that before. And the freaking drill sergeants are, like, stepping on it and shaking it and shit. And the story goes that the guy goes up, he takes a step on it, freaks out, turns around, comes back down. Drill sergeant goes over and yells at him. You know, he goes back up, comes back down. Captain goes over and yells at him, goes up, takes two more steps than he did the first time, but freaks out, comes back down. Yeah. Old man colonel walks out, full bird colonel. What's going on? They tell him, sir, we have a soldier. He just can't get across the course. He goes over to talk to soldier, and the captain and the sergeant are talking to each other like, man, I don't want to be that soldier. He's fixing to lay into his ass harder than we ever did, you know. And the captain says, yeah, man, I'm even scared of the colonel. Shit. Colonel walks over, talks to him for a couple seconds, real quiet. Guy goes up, walks across the thing, comes back down the other side. Sergeant Major comes walking out, seeing what's going on, and the captain and the sergeant fill him in. He said, well, of course he did. That's why he's the colonel. He knows what to say to get the person motivated. Your job as an educator for kids, your primary job is to make them see the value in learning that which they need to learn. To become incentivized to learn without it being because I said so. We are so quick to use, and not just necessarily those specific words, but that attitude when we're dealing with children. Shut up and do it, Johnny, because you need to, because I said so, because the teacher said so. And when you give someone the clout and authority inside academic settings, they're very quick to do it. Well, why do I have to learn this? Because you're going to need it someday. No, I'm not. Shut up and do it. That's not going to work. You have to figure out what is the thing that will motivate the learner. And sometimes do it or you're in trouble is the thing that works for some of the kids. That's actually quite effective with my grandson. Look, dude, you need to get this done right now or you're not going to be doing jack shit for the rest of the day. Or you could get it done and have 6 hours to yourself to do whatever you want. It's up to you. That does not freaking hold an ounce of water with my granddaughter. She'll just say, okay, and then she'll cry. So you can't use the same motivation for everybody. Everybody has a different motivational, like that sergeant and that captain. Most of the guys they yelled at went up the thing and went across it. But what about the one that won't? You see? And so what works for my granddaughter? Telling her stories about what it will do for her if she can learn, like how reading is a superpower. That's all I got. Like, she was animate. I'm not going to learn to read. And Sue's words were just going in my head like, oh, my God. I can't make her do something she don't want to do. So I had this discussion with her about how reading was a superpower. And her mommy had it, and her daddy had it, and her brother had it, and I had it, and grandma had it. She's the only one who didn't have a superpower. Well, shit, I got to have a superpower. As we're coming up now with math and reading at a higher level and all, and having to write, this girl's money motivated. I understand that. I'm like, well, you want a business to make money? Yeah. Like Papa does? Yeah. Okay, well, you have to be able to read, write, and do math, or you can't have a business. It's impossible. I'm not going to run it for you. I'll help you, but you're going to have to do it. If you want to be able to make money for yourself, you have to know these things. That motivates her. You know what that does with my grandson? Jack diddly crap. The boy is not motivated by money. You know, he just isn't. And so that's just two kids in the same family being raised by the same parents and the same grandparents. And they're drastically different because that's how humans are. So we will never be able to change the current system in order to really serve learners with the current structure of that system. And there are gigantic forces that do not wish for that to be changed. Keep that in mind as we go along. Remember, I am one-eyed Jack for real. I can only see out of one eye. That's why I have this wandering left eye over here. And that means that if you want to have me talk about something or answer a question today, it is important, it is in fact imperative that you follow the proper format if you're in the live stream, which is the word question in all caps, and then I might notice it and start. If you super chat me, whatever you say, well, it will absolutely 100% end up starred. I'll have no choice but to pay attention to it. And that's even if you do it for 99 cents with a super sticker or whatever the hell YouTube calls it. All right, so let's get on to this. 10 skills to teach kids. And I, like I say, adults alike, because a lot of the things that I'm going to talk about, I'm going to throw out a guess here. There'll be less than 1% of people who will watch or listen to this podcast that won't, if they're honest, be able to say there's at least one thing in here that I really don't know how to do, or I've never done, but I think I can do it, but I've never done it, or I can do that, but not really well. I really, you know, like I remember doing that when I was 12 or something, but I wouldn't know what to do today. And these are all things that I think expand opportunity in life for you. In fact, if you could do everything I'm going to give you today, it'd be pretty hard not to be able to at least establish a decent business, assuming you do have, you know, reading, writing, and math as well taken care of. All right. So I think one of the things that, and I'm about to do this with my grandson. I think he's at a level now where it will start to matter to him when he's able to look at this. How to use Excel to do a takeoff, right? So he's not money motivated, but he does want certain things. And so he's getting to the point now where he thinks about like how to build a thing or whatever, you know. And so if you can do a takeoff, which is an estimate, which is what the primary job I did is when I was a sales engineer in data cabling. That was the primary thing I did was write the sales copy and put together the takeoff. So you give a price with project estimation as far as the profit that we could make on the job. And I would sit down with a project manager and say, am I missing anything here? Is there, you know, have you worked in an environment like this? Do we need to add some labor hours or whatever? And then, you know, the ops manager at the beginning would sign off on it after I was there for a couple of months. They're like, you just go. You got this. But, and then I could take that and go to a customer and give them a price, but I could also explain the price if they had, like, why is it this expensive? Well, what, you know, my sales technique was basically, well, here's what we did. this is why it costs that much. Now, we're not giving away our margins on the back end. You don't do that. But, you know, this is what this costs. What would you like me to take out of here? Or if I had a competitor and they said, well, your competitor's, you know, 20% lower. Did my competitor do this? And most of the times my competitors did not. Their estimates were like 2 sheets of paper and a price with a basic saying we're going to install 165 cables or whatever. Where we had a complete description of the entire project and a complete breakdown of the takeoff, all the materials, all where all the labor was. Again, pricing was our pricing to them, not our underlying cost, which I had, you know, in my takeoff. So here's what I'm saying about this. You teach a kid to do that, they're actually qualified to be a construction salesperson and many other types of sales as well, but definitely a construction salesperson. This is a hard skill, even though it's a soft skill. It has real world dividends. But you know what else it lets you do? You know, I'm thinking about building a deck. Okay. And I'm thinking about doing it myself to save some money. Okay. So you go ahead and you build that takeoff. And then you say, okay, this is going to cost me $4,500. Now, if you turn around and say, I don't know if I have time to build this deck, and you bring somebody in to, quote, doing the job for you, you can figure out about what the labor should be on that. And you know if you're getting an honest quote or not. And if you don't like the number, then you should be able to ask that person to explain it to you, and they should be able to do it, or they just threw out a number, which many of them do. There's another thing you need to know that this skill helps you with. When somebody's number's too fucking low, that is a recipe for disaster. On any kind of thing, you hire a contractor to do at your house. You want the fair price. You want the honest price. You want the lower price. Maybe. What you don't want is somebody that's 20% under the cost of the job to them in the end. Not the part you see, the part that they see, like their labor and all that. When you go from being a profitable customer to being a losing job, you go to the back of the line for everything. That contractor is out trying to sell the next big job to get a deposit to be able to afford to finish your job. You are now a pain in the ass. Okay? You are a pain in the ass when somebody's losing money on you. You have to have a company with extreme integrity for them to stick with you once they know they screwed up. And so that was another conversation I would have with customers. This skill that just seems like how Excel works is literally half your job training in that trade world. But yet there's all kinds of things you can do with it. I've sat with people and taught them how to use Excel. And once they start realizing, wait, I can make a worksheet for this and I can just change quantities and everything automatically updates. I can produce graphs with it. I can integrate those into a PowerPoint presentation. You know what you can do now? Now you can give a presentation in front of a board of fucking directors like I used to have to do. Right? You start learning things like how to manipulate axes a little bit, and you can make things look a little better or worse than they are depending on what you're trying to sell. So, and this is really not a sales skill. It's just one of the things that can be done with it. I would bet that many people that are listening to me right now in the live or will listen to me later on the audio know exactly what I'm talking about. You use Excel in your job, or you have, or in your business. Or you're using something that really is like an Excel backend, but it's been packaged to look nice, like Master Builder version 6. It's nothing but Excel with paint on it, right? If that software even still exists, because I used that in the 90s. But how to do a basic takeoff or estimate in Excel. And that's not all the things Excel can do, just the basics of quantities, parts, and basic algebra used to come up with final numbers and answers so that the whole thing will work as a worksheet, not just as a base Excel thing. Next, I try to do a lot of variety in this today, too. So basic small livestock husbandry. I think everybody should learn how to take care of some form of small livestock. Chickens, quail, rabbits. Those are probably your three best options there. Of the three, I would tell you that the most sustainable for the most people is rabbits, because I can't feed quail and chickens with my lawn. You know, I can't plant a few willow trees and a few mulberry trees in a hedgerow to cut from and get a bagging lawnmower and go on YouTube and put how to make a small micro hay baler so I can make hay to feed my rabbits through my winter and do that with chickens or quail. Chickens and quail both have great places, and I keep chickens and I have kept quail and I don't keep rabbits. So, you know, it's, I guess me not eating my own dog food there or something, but I'm not saying everybody should do rabbits. I'm saying if what you want is something that's infinitely sustainable, rabbits are the way to go. They also have a fantastic manure product, which is all the fertility that you would need, along with some good compost, to grow all the food you want for yourself and for more rabbits. So it is a complete turnkey system when it's put together the right way. And you add stuff to it like, you know, if you put rabbits over worms, so the worms are eating the manure and you're worm composting while you're making the rabbit, you know, into meat rabbits or whatever, you have an amazingly, amazingly sustainable system, like infinitely sustainable. You don't care if you know, the feed store is out of food. You know, I think that anybody doing this should probably keep some pellets around for your rabbits as a backup. Always have some alfalfa pellets or something like that. But overall, you don't really care. You don't care about fertilizer. You got all fertilizer you need. And it's a business. You want to see the business in rabbits? The business in rabbits is selling breeders until everybody that wants to do it has them. People are buying pairs of rabbits for a hell of a lot more than they'll ever get for that rabbit as meat. A hell of a lot more. I saw one dude on Craigslist this weekend checking into it. And he's selling meat rabbits, but he's selling the meat for $10 a pound. That's dressed and skinned and all. He's actually selling the organ meat, the heart, the liver, and I think the kidneys. It was three organs, but it's definitely heart and liver, for $20 a pound. Because there's so many people getting the carnivore, paleo, primal nutrition, I guess that they want that. And so he's selling the offal for more than the meat. And he's selling everything else for dog food, right? And then on top of that, he's selling breeders. And when you look at everything he's doing, he's making more money selling breeders than anything else. More money selling breeder rabbits than anything else. So there's a business in it. There's an endless food supply in it, and there's a skill set in it. And I'll tell you, I think this is incredibly valuable. I think that any kid that I've ever met that's gone through like FFA or something like that, is taking care of livestock, they are a more well-balanced young adult by the time they're ready to leave school than kids that didn't. So I think there's that. I also think there is, most people are afraid of what will happen if they don't comply with what they're told to do. How will I pay my bills? How will I feed myself? Every single skill set a person learns relieves that fear some. Even if they don't practice it on a daily basis. Like if you're a kid and you learned how to take care of a couple hutches of rabbits and get meat rabbits out of that, how to feed them out of your backyard and stuff, even when you've gone off to live in the city and pursue your career, in the back of your head, you know what? If I need to, you give me some rabbits and a fishing rod and I'll eat. Learn how to frame, I'll build a damn house, right? The more you are able to do things that the average person can't do, not only the more valuable you are to others, the more valuable you are to yourself, and you know it. And taking the fear away is the most important thing that we should be doing with education. What if? Instead, what does the current system literally do? It makes kids terrified. It makes them terrified. If they don't get good enough test scores and grades, they won't get into college and their life will be over. That's the central themed message in middle and high school right now. If you don't do good enough, you won't get anywhere, which is a lie. It's an absolute fabricated, fucked up lie to be telling a kid, you know, 14, 15 years old, that what he's doing now is going to set the course for the rest of his fucking life and he's done. He will be working at Walmart scrubbing shitters if he doesn't get into Harvard. It's bullshit. And it's because, what did I say at the beginning? They have a one-size-fits-all thing when it comes to making a kid do their work and learn. Do it or else. And all you have is various, all that is a different flavor. Is, it, you know, when you tell the kid, like, it's an individual thing, like you're trying to get them to do this one project or whatever, or be quiet in class on this one day, And the teacher says, Johnny, if you don't sit down, shut up, and do your work, I'm going to give you detention. Right? That is do it or else. But the larger macro message of, you know, your life will be shit if you don't do what we tell you, is just another version of do it or else. They don't have anything else. That's all they got. I'm sorry. It's true. I'm not sorry, honestly. Don't be apologizing for shit you didn't do wrong. We're going to get to that today, actually. I also think we should be teaching kids how to intelligently debate both sides of any given issue. And there's a reason for this. A lot of people think it's so you'll be more open-minded about other people's ideas. No, bullshit. Like, if you really know a subject, you don't need somebody else's opinion on it who doesn't know a subject. What you need to be able to do is actually research a topic and form a real opinion, right? A real opinion on an issue because you are informed about the issue. And I don't know a better skill set for this than being a good debater. We had debate in school, and the way it worked, they were scored debates, and you would be given the topic and the two sides of the issue. And the day of the debate, when you showed up, they'd tell you which side you had. And it could be a side you didn't agree with at all. But you had to know enough about it to sound intelligent in your debate, taking the side that they gave you. And it was one of the most, and I'm saying, school is worse now. That is one of the most valuable things that I learned in high school, was how to debate effectively. And it's why, when a lot of times we're like, well, if you just knew, then you would believe too. No, I wouldn't, because I do know. I've actually researched the thing. I've researched the thing enough that I know everything that you're going to say, and I know every counter argument to it and every fact to support that counter argument. And what I hated was getting the topic I didn't really believe in. It was much more difficult to be passionate and articulate about something you don't believe in. But by having to do it, you're developing the ability to think independently for yourself. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. Kids love to argue with each other, and we get in the way. A debate is just a logical and well-mannered argument. That's all that it is. You're discussing a topic, and we're arguing it. And the gold standard for education I've talked about before is the Socratic method. Is in Socrates. And that's Socratic method is basically debate. You make a statement, and the Socrat takes the opposite position, even if they agree with you. And if, you know, you say, well, all people must do this thing. Well, what does all people mean? That would be the first question a Socrat would ask if you made a statement like that. And what do you mean by must? What are the consequences if they don't? So is this your opinion, or are you you see what I'm saying? And so the best form of education known to man, and I mean, people with doctorates in education will agree with this, and then they don't teach this way. But it is the Socratic method, and that's all debate really is you're setting people up to be each other's Socrat in a discussion. And it is, again, it is incredibly valuable. And a person who is an effective debater, right? I mean, from a career standpoint, they make great lawyers. Like, you could say, you know, lawyers do the same thing. There's plenty of times a lawyer is acting in defense of the client, and they know damn well he's guilty. And you might think, well, if he was a good lawyer, he wouldn't defend that person. Well, he shouldn't lie on their behalf. I would agree with that. But he should give them the best defense possible, like don't talk right now. That would be one thing that lawyers are really good at doing. Shut up. I will tell you when to talk. I might even tell you what to say and when to say it. But right now, shut up. Right? Because lawyers understand that the more information you provide to someone coming at you, the more ammunition you give them, even when you think you're helping yourself. You're not. So, but the big thing is that a lawyer will have to argue a case on behalf of a client that they either don't agree with or like. And that's why they make great debaters, good debaters make great lawyers. But it's the number one bullshit detection device you can give somebody. So if you think to yourself, right, if you think to yourself, well, my kid grows up, I want them to be immune to being bullshitted as much as possible, then they need to learn how to debate. And again, debating from the format of you get to know the topic, but you don't get to know what side you're on in the topic. That's the most effective method that I have ever seen. In fact, I have even been part of like practice debates where you literally 50% through the allotted time switch your position. Okay, now you're pro and you're anti. That's a bitch. Because now you're debating yourself and you're debating a skilled opponent. But it is incredibly valuable, right? Moving on. And this is part of that when they kind of go together like sisters, you know. And that is how to identify logical fallacy. Because that's a skill within debate, but it has a lot of other places that it's really relevant. How to know when somebody's moving the goalposts, right? How to know when somebody's putting up a straw man argument, right? How to know when somebody's using cherry picking in their arguments. And the thing about logical fallacies is since we literally had a social science of identifying and naming them, like a taxonomy of them, basically, they're incredibly easy to spot. You either are like, oh, I'm dealing with a cherry picking fallacy here, or it looks like cherry picking, but is it? Or is this a legitimate argument? Right? Because everybody's guilty of cherry picking in a debate. You always cherry pick because you want to make the case for your side. You're not going to lay out the argument of your opponent fully for them, right? You don't want to do that. So there's always some level of it, but is it legitimate or illegitimate when it comes down to it? Are you leaving out things that are critical, or are you simply cherry picking the things that are most critical to the argument? So it's really easy to see when somebody starts moving the goalposts. Very, very easy to see. When somebody's using ad hominem in a debate or an argument or to make a case, that is blatantly obvious. If you even, you know, if you know what it is, you should see it immediately. That's where we attack the source rather than the argument. Well, he's just stupid, right? That would be the word, but he's a liberal, or this magazine is from a bad publisher, or Jack, I can't believe you shared that news article. It's from Russia Today. Yeah, but is it true? Is it true? You know, and the person that would turn around and tell you, well, I would trust the New York Times. Well, did you read the article and see where they were actually commentating on the fact that's in the headline that was published in the New York Times? Oh, well, it's still from Russia. See, it's just so stupid. It's such a stupid, and you know what it is? It is a lazy person's argument. I am too fucking lazy to investigate the truth about this, but I know that I don't like it, so I'll just attack the source so this person that's talking to me will go away, right? There was, if you wanted a PhD in identifying ad hominem attacks, you had one for about 3 years. With COVIDs, right? Because that's all that was done constantly. When anybody had an opinion that diverged 1%, they never attacked the opinion. You ever notice that? They never said, here's why that's wrong. They said, experts say shut up and go away, right? That means you're not an expert. We had doctors saying, I've observed this in my practice, and we had reporters who have literally never read a fucking scientific study in their life saying, where's your study? Where was it published? I observed this over the last 3 weeks in my office. That's empirical, you know, observation. That's totally valid. Doctors have done that forever. That's what we expect from doctors. But they weren't allowed to do it then, were they? Right? Fallacy ad hominem. So I would say that if you have a young learner at home, whether they go to school or not, I would take one logical fallacy a week and discuss that logical fallacy. 5 minutes at a time is all you need. You talk about it. And here's the thing, though. If your kid is in the state school system, you might be creating some letters home to you or something like that. Because once they know how to do it, they'll see it all over the place. So you might want to think about exactly when and how you do that one. Here's another one I think we need to be teaching kids. And I learned this in seventh friggin' grade. Basic first aid. We got CPR certification in seventh grade health class. I don't think I teach that anymore. You know, there's probably a Red Cross basic first aid class somewhere near you in the next 60 days that you can take with your kids. How we do not teach basic first aid in school anymore, I don't even understand. You talk about value. The fact that you know to apply pressure to a wound can and does save lives every fucking day. There are so many lives that are saved that, yes, in the end, it is a doctor that does the kind of final part, you know, putting the things back together, stitching it up or whatever. But had not somebody been there when it happened that went, I'm going to take a rag and I'm going to push on this and scream help until somebody comes. And I'm not going to let this person bleed out. That happens every freaking day, multiple times every freaking day. Something like that happens. And we have been getting to the point where society is becoming more and more dangerous in the way that people are acting and conducting themselves and injuring each other. We all need to have basic first aid knowledge. We don't all have to become doctors or ditch medicine pros or something like that. But what to do in trauma situations to get the person to a higher level and standard of care. When I was in the military, one of the classes I got to take was called Combat Lifesavers. And to this day, it's some of the most valuable training I ever got. And it was a high stress training. Like when you would go through courses and get graded on what you did, you'd have one instructor that's telling you things because the guy's not really dying. You know, he's not really bleeding. You know, when you check a pulse on a living person pretending to be there, you're going to get a pulse. So they would tell you if you're getting, they were the nice guy. They were the good cop. And they just scored you. And they never said you did it right or wrong. They never interfered with anything you did. They would just, when they saw you, like I said, when they saw you take a pulse, you're getting a pulse, but it's very weak. Right? And then the other person, the other like instructor at that station was screaming at you while you were doing it. You're doing it wrong. You're going to kill him. You're going to be the one that has to tell his mama why he's not coming home because you're so effing stupid, you dumb son of a bitch. You're killing. And you might be doing everything right. That was the only way they could really put the stress in a situation. And what you learn in all high stress training is that you do not rise to your highest level of training. You revert to your lowest level of training. You revert to the thing that you could do with a blindfold on. You know, when people say, you know, I know how to do this, can you do it at 3 a.m. with a flashlight in your teeth in the rain when the rain is freezing your skin? If you can, then you really know how to do the thing. If you can't do it in that situation, you know sort of how to do the thing. You're not actually trained. You've been taught, but not trained in the procedure to the point where you can reproduce it immediately. And good education is a blend of teaching and training. Unfortunately, what they're training your kids to do is obey, right? To move when the bell says, to eat when they're told, to not eat when they're told not to, to ask permission to take a piss. That's to be good workers on an assembly line. That's what they're being trained. They're not being trained in procedures that can save lives, which I think every single person should be trained in things that can save lives, right? We really should make that effort. And so this could save your life. There's been more than one instance because a kid knew what to do. Mom or dad is still alive. This could save one of your other children's lives because it's very likely that if you have multiple kids, they're often together when you're not there, even for short periods of time. This could save one of their friends' life because they're definitely with their friends more than they're probably with you. The fact that we do not teach this at a reasonable level anymore in schools is disgusting. And don't tell me it's about budgets because that's bullshit. We have the same number of hours in a school day that we did 35 fucking years ago. I'm sorry we do. And we spend more on kids now than we ever have in the history of education. The United States spends more per pupil than most other countries. And we're at like number 35 in math and science in the world. We're a joke. That's why we're having this discussion. Moving on. Bitcoin. You knew it was going to get in there sooner or later, didn't you? Okay, so about 3 weeks ago, I did a show called Bitcoin Will Eat Everything or something to that effect. And I said in that show that Bitcoin will eat silver's market cap. And it did. And it did in a big way. It was already over it and kind of flirting with it back and forth. But today, it blew silver's market cap out of the water. It is the eighth largest by market cap commodity on planet Earth. And of all those commodities, the only one that you can put in a box and walk around with like a Swiss bank account in your pocket, like Hillary Clinton said, thank you, Hillary, that's a great sales speech, like a Swiss bank account in your pocket, is Bitcoin. The only one you can transfer from one person to another as a bearer instrument is Bitcoin. Yes, Apple stock is valuable. You can't pay me with it. You can't send it to me. You have to sell it through a brokerage. Bitcoin is money, okay? It's money, and it's the most uncensorable and most permissionless. It's the only true permissionless payments network really in the world. Bitcoin's fungible 24/7, 365 days a year, and again, it's now one of the top 10 asset classes in the world. If you're not teaching your kid about it, you really need to ask yourself if you're preparing them for the future. Because if you're not, you're not. This is only going to get bigger. So what do I think you need to be able to do with Bitcoin to have a basic use ability from? You should be able to buy it. You know how to buy it. You got to know how to sell it in case you need fiat and you need to dump some of it to get fiat. You need to know how to hold it securely and safely without leaking information that could put it at risk. You need to know how to do true self-custody. I keep most of my Bitcoin that it's self-custody. When I say that, I mean I have a hardware wallet that goes with it. It is as secure as it gets. And I keep some Bitcoin straight up like in Exodus, just like spendable. You know, a couple $1,000 worth. Never know when. Never sell your Bitcoin. Never spend it. You know, you never know when you can make a deal because you have Bitcoin. Don't do it a lot, but I can always buy more because the first one is how to buy it. So if somebody really wants Bitcoin, $500, boop, and immediately I just buy 500 more. I'm fine with that, right? That's good to go. You should know how to pay with it, again, and you should know how to receive it. And that's not just holding your phone up for somebody to scan. Like, well, if I have a website, how do I let people pay me with this? That is the future of money. If you don't want to believe me, fine. I never said anybody had to do all of them. But I will make damn sure that my grandchildren know how to use Bitcoin because I'm preparing them for the future. And I don't know, people keep talking about Theta. I don't know what that is. But if it's a shit coin, I'm not interested. But if it's anything else, you can tell me. Moving on. How to write a sales pitch. How to write a sales pitch. And a sales pitch, what I mean is, when I talked about my old job way, way, way back in the 90s, right, I did sales for data cabling companies. I actually wrote a sales pitch. I didn't just give them a price. I would describe the entire job end to end, how it would work. In my proposals, I would include things like I would always like, we already know what project manager is going to run. Here's a project manager and lead tech for your job and their cell phone numbers. And that was one of the conversations I used to have when they would have a problem with my price. Did they tell you who your project manager was? Did they list his certifications before, you know, as to why they put him on the job? Did they give you his cell phone number? I'm sure they will if I ask. You didn't have to ask, right? That's part of the sales process, is making sure people have the information that they need and then being able to go back and point it out. But not everybody's going to be a salesperson. Not as a profession. Everybody is going to need to go to some other buddy at some point in their life and ask for things. And that other person is going to have that other buddy is going to have the ability to say no, right? You're a little kid, you go to grandma and you ask for something. You don't always get a yes. Sometimes you get a no. You go to mom and dad, you often get a hell no, no, right? You get a no. Okay. So what is the value in learning how to write an articulate proposal requesting something, whether it's business or a job or a thing? It's learning how to sell an idea is what it really is. In the end, all sales are immaterial, even if there's a physical product on the other end. The true sale happens in the minds of the two parties, the salesperson and the prospect. When the prospect switches to customer, the sale process is complete, not necessarily product delivery. When you go buy something online, it's been sold. The product doesn't show up for what, a day, two, three? It used to be 4 to 6 weeks, right? Remember that? Or 6 to 8 weeks, no CODs. Remember those commercials, right? The sale always happens in an invisible realm. And the person that knows how to write a good proposal can get into just about any college that they want to get into, for instance, as one thing. You know, you think about, we don't teach sales, and we actually act like it's a bad thing to teach people how to sell. And then we say, go get into college, Johnny, and make it a good one. Okay. We tell people, you know, don't ask for money. It's rude. And Johnny goes to college, like you said. He gets educated, but he's been programmed all his life to believe asking for money is bad. Now he needs to go to a venture capitalist and ask for money to start up his business. You see the conflict there? So this is the beauty of this one. Because this goes back to Sulu Preece's freaking statement that you can't prevent a child from learning what they want to learn. So all you have to do is make them want to learn and then let nature take its course. So what I'm suggesting you do to teach this one, and you got to have a kid that's old enough to do it, that's got enough understanding of the written language to be able to do it. Pick a thing you're going to be willing to say yes for, but also pick a thing that's sort of a big ask. I'm sure they'll come up with one sooner or later and say, you know what, Billy, Johnny, Susie, Tommy, whatever, right? Yes, so glad you asked that, because I have a project for you. And they're going to think it's like, go clean the gutters, and I'll say yes, right? I wouldn't do that, though. I would say, hey, you want it? Convince me. Well, see, if you get it, then I'll do this stuff. Whoa. I want you to write me a proposal. Multiple pages explaining the value to you, the value to me, the value to the family, why you selected the thing that you're asking for. Why not some other product or other brand or whatever? I want you to, in writing, extol the virtues of this thing. And if you do a good job, I will sign it like signing a contract and agree to do it. Well, there are so many jobs that's the primary thing that you do. Even people that don't think they're salespeople, project managers do this all the time. Engineers do this all the time. There are so many jobs where the only way you get something done is an effective proposal. So it's career training. But it also then leverages the concept of, do I really want to spend this money? Like, I need you to explain to me why you're not spending your money on it. Probably the answer is the Michael Saylor answer, his first business that he ever started. I can't remember the company. He went to some big company, I think DuPont or somebody. He just basically, because I don't have the money. You have to give it to me because I don't have it. I guess that'll work if they really, really want you, but that can't work for your kids. So if you had the money, would you spend it or wouldn't you? Because if you wouldn't spend your money, I need you to convince me of this thing. You think they want to? I mean, they're the one that came to you and said, and if they don't do it, don't chase them. They'll come back. They'll either ask for that thing again or you won't have to do it because they decided it wasn't worth the effort. If it ain't worth the effort of you writing up a couple pages, it ain't worth the effort of me spending my money and time on it. I'm not going to do it. Wouldn't be prudent. Not going to do it, right? I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to eat more broccoli. I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember all that. And it wasn't, you know, the thing was, it really wasn't George H.W. It was Dana Carvey, pretending to be him. That, you know, that's just part of what comedians do. But yeah, sales pitch, right? Here's a totally different one. How to make plants from cuttings. And start with easy ones. Sweet potato slips. Goji berry. Stupid easy. Longevity spinach. Certain mulberry species. Really, really easy to do. Hybrid poplar tree. Really, really easy to make cuttings from. Little pot like that. Moist soil. Stick. Put it under plant lights or a shady spot. Boom, willows. That's Green Country Agroforestry saying, well, yeah. I learned how to do this. I had to be 7 or 8 years old. My grandma taught me how to do it with a plant called Wandering Jew. Figs are good, too. Figs are good, too. But Wandering Jew. My grandma was a big plant lady. I'm talking about my Italian grandmother, my mom's side. They were that side of the family was never big on growing food. I kind of got it from both. She was more just into horticulture. She just liked plants. She had light setups and all the new plant starts and stuff. And, you know, we would go to the store and she buys this little plant. She'd be like, I paid $2 for this plant, but I'm going to take it home and I'm going to use it to make 50 of them. Well, how are you going to do that? And she showed me, just cut it and stick it in some water. It starts rooting. Then you put it in a pot. I was a little kid. I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. You can make plants that easy? I taught my granddaughter. My grandson doesn't give a shit about that, right? Like, it's a different motivation, different gifts. I showed my granddaughter how to do that. She made $50 at the last workshops on longevity spinach cuttings. I told her this year, if she'll go out and make me 100 goji berries and 100 white mulberries, I'll buy them all from her. I either have to do it myself or pay somebody to do it. I'd rather pay my granddaughter. Will she do it? I don't know. We'll see, right? We'll find out. If she does, great. If not, well, then you don't see. And that's the thing. One of the things we need to start realizing, you know, with Sue's words, you can't prevent a child from learning a thing that they want to learn, is that these extra activities, we should try to encourage it as much as possible. But we also have to be okay with the fact not everybody's going to do everything. That's okay. When we get done with this series, let's say that we do 5 of them. That'll be 50 skills by the time we're done. Anybody out there can do 25 of them is so far ahead of their peers, especially kids at this point, young adults at this point. You know, like I said, I saw my grandfather fix a carburetor on a boat with a busted screwdriver and a crescent wrench. That crescent wrench was a pry bar. It was a hammer. You know, it did everything to get that damn boat running so we could get back to shore. But you know, people today, like, you're called a Coast Guard because you're walking distance from the shore of a lake, is the way some people would act. It's time that we change that. And it's by getting them exposed as much as possible, and they'll grab onto the ones that interest them, and you won't be able to stop them. But you can say, hey, you know what? I know you're not really into this one, but we're going to do this one this week. And you know, you can come up with a lot of stuff like this and say, here, pick something from the list. You get to pick one. We do that one first, and then I get to pick one. And since I did what you wanted, you have to do what I – you start treating them like adults. Isn't this how adults make deals? Like, you picked the restaurant last time, so I get to do it this time? Start treating your children with the respect you would give an adult. It doesn't mean you say yes to – that's not – respect is not always saying yes. Respect is communicating in an articulate manner and only using your authority when and where and as necessary. If you're always using your authority all the time, then your authority begins to wane over time and people stop listening to you. You know where that's happening in droves now? Schools. You can blame parents. You can blame kids. In the end, if you are always doing nothing but using authority, eventually it wears out. You know, I talked about the military commander at the beginning of this. The best leaders in the military are people that will be followed regardless of their rank. The most effective leadership in any company is the leader within. It's the person that doesn't even have the leadership job yet, but everybody's already following them, right? That is where the most action happens. is the leader that becomes the leader before they have the position. They're natural leaders, and therefore they are fallen. I mean, that's also something they won't teach you, because if they teach you that, then you're like, so that's not you. Why are you in charge? I mean, I had some good teachers in school, but I had some, they were about as inspiring as a used condom in a back alley. I mean, they just, you just, oh, why am I here? Why am I here? I had one history teacher. It was amazing. I had another one. I could have literally taught the class better than he did. But we can teach people to become leaders. A lot of people never become leaders because they're never given the opportunity to lead. And they're never given respect, and they're never modeled to what a real leader looks like. There's so few leaders. One of my favorite books, I wonder what happened to it, because I had an audio version of it, but it was before Audible. I might buy it on Audible and re-listen to it. It was by Lee Iacocca. I did a whole episode on it way back in like 08 or 09. It was called Where Have All the Leaders Gone? It was an outstanding book. And I really liked Lee Iacocca. Liked some things I liked about him and some things I didn't like about him. But overall, he was a very smart person. Very, very articulate. I learned an amazing amount of things about the world in that book. Like Fidel Castro was willing to make any deal the United States wanted to make 30 years before, you know, 30 years ago from today, 10 years before that book came out in the early 2000s. Basically told the United States government, tell us what you need from us and we'll do it. And we basically said, no, thank you. No, thank you. Just don't worry about it. We don't really want to do anything. But yeah, the other takeaway from that was that there's just not enough leaders, because the only way to create leaders is to model leadership for the next generation of leaders. So leadership skills will probably make the cut of the next one. Another one I think that we should be teaching kids, though, is how to plan a trip. How to plan a trip. Well, this is pretty easy. The next time you're going to go on vacation, pick two places that you're happy to use, either one of them. Tell the kid, which one do you want? Whichever one they say, you say, well, I was really thinking of the other one, but I'll tell you what. You do a good job of planning the entire trip out. You get me prices on airfare if you're taking that, or rental car, or gas, right? We're going to drive, you know, we're going to take the vehicle gets this much mileage. What is an average gas price? What route would we take to get there? If we're going to fly in, what's our route from the airport? All the things that you do. A list of all of the things that we need to take with us. You know, what do we need to pack? Don't you do this every time you go on vacation, right? And you might not put them in charge of, like, what you have to do to shut your business down or to put in for vacation with your boss or whatever. But everything else that you do, don't do it. Maybe you do it just in case. But, again, you can't get a kid to do something they don't want to do other than by force, and then it's never good. But if you can motivate them to want to do a thing, you can't stop them. There'll be no stopping. You know how I became so well informed? Some of you that are new to the show won't know this, but I know an awful lot about reptiles and amphibians. I'm a full-on amateur herpetologist. And the one that I know, the species that I know the most about are snakes. I know snakes backwards and forwards. I know just about every, you know, snake that's indigenous to the United States of America. I know what they eat. I know what they where they live. I know the ones that are venomous and the ones that are not. You know, I know how to properly house them. And I only did that. Because my parents were absolutely adamant that I would not own a snake as a kid. And I believed that if I could answer all their objections, that I would one day own a snake as a kid. And guess what? It happened. My first snake was just a common king snake. I was overjoyed by it. But there was nothing that could stop me from learning that, because I had an incentive. I wanted to own a snake. And the only way I was going to get one, because there was an authority figure saying no, no how, no chance, no way, was to know so much that I would overload them with information and wear them down. And eventually, like, if you'll shut up, whatever. You have to buy it yourself. Oh, that's a yes. Done. And I, you know what? One thing I knew about sales, even before I knew I was doing sales, when you close, shut up. Stop talking. Take the order and go, right? So that's what I did. But, you know, if you can tell this kid, like, yeah, you know, like I said, the other one was something they want. Make them write you sales copy for it. Like, why should a proposal? Like a marketing proposal. Well, with the trip, they want to go to the place. Well, you plan it. And then you can't say, here's the beauty of this. There's a lot of things you do as a parent when you go on vacation that makes you need a vacation from your vacation by the time you come back. You got to tell them, we got to go now. But why? They don't understand why. They're happy. Right? And by the way, if you don't really need to do something, you're on vacation, your kids are happy, leave it alone. Leave it alone. I told a story this weekend to some of my friends about my son and daughter-in-law when they were with us in Florida. The kids were in the pool at the hotel, and they were happy as shit. They were playing with other kids. They decided they want to go get ice cream, and they dragged the kids out of the pool, and everybody ended up miserable. Shocking. Oh, I would have never expected that to happen. But, you know, you don't listen to grandparents until you become one. But if you can get them to do that work, you won't have to explain what time you have to get up in the morning and go to the airport. They'll have already figured that out. They will be vested in the vacation, and therefore you will work together instead of against each other while you're on it. And they'll learn that skill and how to do it. You know, I there were things that I knew how to do that I didn't understand that my contemporaries didn't. When I moved to Texas from Pennsylvania after I got out of the military, I was only 21 years old. And I had a good friend who was like 1 year behind me in school. So he had graduated by then. So he's like 20. And he's like, well, when are you leaving? And I'm like, next week. He goes, oh, okay. How are you going to do this? I said, what do you mean how? And this guy wasn't stupid, by the way. This isn't Heath or Mikey, right? This is a guy named Tim. He actually ended up being my roommate in Texas for a while when he moved down for a while. But he said, I wouldn't know. I mean, you're moving. Like, well, I was in the Army. I was in Panama and other places. And, you know, yeah, but they do everything for you. I'm like, yeah, kind of. They tell you where to go and you go there. He was just like, he literally couldn't figure out. I'm like, I'm just going to take all the shit that's most important to me that will fit in my little car and drive to my buddy's house, and I'll figure it out when I get there. He was overwhelmed by the prospect of me doing it, let alone him doing it for himself. Maybe that's part of our failure to launch problem that we have nowadays, where kids don't move out and do things. And you can say it's pricing and all, and we're going to have a show on that soon, because I will tell you that it is harder right now for a young person to start their life than it is in my lifetime. There was a lot of excuse making for a lot of years by young people. I'm like, shut up. It was the same for everybody. You're supposed to be broke when you're young. That's how it works. Stop watching TV and think that that's how life is. It is now really, really difficult. But why do we have the problem when it wasn't so difficult? Maybe it's because kids literally don't know how. Like, if you think, well, they know because they lived on their own when they were in college. No, they lived in a dorm with a bunch of other college kids. They were treated like children by the school that they went to, who took their money happily, that they're now signed into for the rest of their lives. But they really didn't learn to live on their own. They didn't really learn to pay bills. They didn't really learn how to plan. They just went to school and learned a thing, hopefully. Because many of them go to school and don't even learn the thing that they paid to learn, from what I can see. But have them plan a trip, pricing, travel, budget, where to visit, etc. Like, you know, put in two places you want to go to while we're there, besides the hotel and the beach, right? And doesn't mean you're going to do it all their way either. Then you can sit down and go, Dad can't really afford to do this and this. We need to pick one. So they can see, like, I think it's good that we shelter kids from some of the sausage making behind the scenes and running a household. Right. And we should. If your angst is about money, you don't want to transfer that to your kids. It's better that your kids don't know that, but they should also understand the value of money and that why you can't always say yes. But I think when you're talking about something like a vacation, they're like, I want to go to the aquarium and I want to go to the zoo. Okay. Both of those are pretty expensive, Billy. They're both pretty expensive. Hell, give them a budget to work with. They'll come to that themselves. Like, I can't make the numbers work. Because isn't that what you do? Isn't that what you do? And this is not stressful because this is a vacation. The whole point is to make it not stressful. Well, what I mean this is not stressful is you're not making them decide between paying the health insurance bill and the groceries. That they should be sheltered from. And you can do this. It doesn't have to be a big vacation. You know, if you're going to take a day off work, but you go to the zoo, put them in charge of planning the trip. You know, that's an easier first step. When are we going to go? How are we going to get there? How much are tickets going to cost? What are they going to try to upsell us for? How much is a freaking hamburger at the zoo? Can we bring our own food? If not, should we eat before we go so that we're going to use, you know, less of that since we know the food sucks there? Put them in charge. There's something about when you put somebody in charge of something, they see it differently than you telling them what you did for them. Way differently. Everybody wants to be the boss until they get promoted and see what the boss actually does. That's what I'm saying. So why not start out much younger with that lesson? Everybody, you have, what kid has not said, when I grow up, I'm going to have my own money and I'm going to make my own rules. Yeah, but do you know what that's going to be like? Let's give you, isn't it better that we give people tastes of things along the way? I just had this conversation with my grandson. I explained to him, I'm like, you're 13 years old. That's pretty young. But it's also only 7 years from being 20. And it's only 5 years from being 18. And when you're 18, I don't think they'll do it, but your parents can literally say, get your shit and get out. They're on no obligation to provide for you at all anymore. His eyes were the size of saucers. And I said that. I'm like, don't worry, we're going to help you. I'm like, but, you know, you're going to graduate school and you're going to decide whether you go to college or take up a trade or something like that. You're going to make that decision. Eventually, you're going to have rent or a mortgage payment. You're going to have a car payment. You're going to have to put gas in your own car. You're going to have your car's oil changed. Like, you're going to have to pay for insurance. And I'm like, do you think it would make a lot of sense for us to just go along the way we are with this? And one day you're 18 and we say, have at it, boy. Good luck. Or should we transfer those responsibilities to you a little at a time so that by the time you get there, it's natural for you to take them on? And the kids snap to that like instantly. Well, no, the first one sounds terrible. But isn't that what we do with most of our kids? I mean, they, you know, 16, they can learn to drive, or 15 and a half or whatever it is in your state, you know. But overall, don't most parents just send their kids to school and figure, hey, we pay a lot of property taxes. They must be doing a good job. Teachers are heroes that don't wear capes, blah, 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 blah. Surely they'll learn everything I learned in school. And, okay, you're 18 now, Johnny, go for it. It's not how it works. You know, this is a good parenting philosophy, not just an educational philosophy. I used to tell my son when he was little, my goal is that every year I have less rules for you. If I don't have less rules for you next year than I do this year, I'm doing a bad job as your dad. You know, and I also explain, like, if you are going to do the right thing anyway, why do you need rules? He's like, I don't. That's where we're trying to get you. Transfer the responsibility slowly across time. This is an easy one, but how often do you have to do this? Because, yes, planning a vacation is a way that you do this. Don't you plan shit out in your life all the time? You check your calendar. Can I do it this day? Can I get off work for this thing? You know, or do I have, like, I could get off, but I have a big presentation that Monday that I have to make, and I really don't need to, I'll need to do this after that. We have to make these decisions. Give your kids the opportunity to start making some decisions. And then here's my last one. And I think this is one, and my wife is great at teaching this. This has to be taught on an ongoing basis. How to apologize. And how to accept an apology when you were not the one that did anything wrong. Graciously, but also not saying it's okay. If somebody does something that's a transgression against you and they apologize, a response is something like, I forgive you. Please try not to do that to me again. That's a gracious, heartfelt acceptance of an apology. It's okay means you didn't do anything wrong. Subconsciously, you're programming that person to do this to you again. We also do not apologize like this. I'm sorry. And for those that are on the audio, I turned my head and looked away. No, when we do something wrong, especially to somebody in our family, whether it's a mistake or intentional, does not matter. We did it. We look that person in the eye. We talk straight to them with respect. And we say, I am sorry. We don't say, but you did this other thing. We don't do that. We don't blame shift. We do not talk like a fucking politician, to be blunt. Right? We do not spin doctor our apologies. You're only apologizing because you screwed up. You screwed up because you were mad. You were screwed up because you made a mistake. You screwed up because you were in a bad mood, whatever it was. But you screwed up. If you didn't screw up, you don't need to apologize because you didn't do anything wrong. Now, many times, especially siblings, right, or friends, young people, both sides did do something wrong. So how do we teach that? We teach that is, you're the one that's realized you did something wrong. You need to apologize for it. But I don't give a shit. That's on him. That's on her. That's on the other party. This is the part that you know you did wrong. You need to apologize for that. Then they apologize. Great. The other person, if they did something wrong, this is the interesting thing. When you have an actual conflict of some kind, and both sides do have some wrong in it, and as long as it's not like a divorce where everybody wants to kill each other, right? Like if it's a typical thing that happens between adults or kids, when that person sincerely apologizes with zero blame shifting, if the other person is remotely mature, they will almost instantly realize I screwed up too and issue a similar apology. Now, here's the thing. You'd think this would be something kids have to work on more than adults. It's not, because it's programming. Remember, it's always programming. So we have been programmed by observing people we are told are our leaders, and they're actors and politicians, right? That's who we model in our behavior, sadly, as a society. I'm not saying everybody does it. I'm saying in mass. We model the behavior that is put before us. So we're into blame shifting. We're into trying to mitigate an apology instead of simply issue it. Yeah? So you apologize not for how the person felt about what you did. I'm sorry that you felt hurt is not an apology. It's a non-apology pretending to be an apology. I'm sorry that I did this thing. Right? Now, if I did a thing that wasn't wrong and you felt hurt, you're not getting an apology from me. And it's not my job to make sure you don't ever feel hurt. Right? If I said something and I was clear and articulate and I wasn't mean or vengeful and you just didn't like it, get over yourself. I respond to, I have a form signature insertion that is that for the emails that I get a couple times a day telling me how angry somebody is with me because of what I said. Not that I'm wrong, but they're just mad. I shouldn't have done that. I just have a click send. That's how often it happens. So my point in this is most people have not experienced in their life a full-on, complete acceptance of what the other party did, total forthright apology. And the longer they have lived that way, the less likely they're to recognize it when they see it. So you give that apology to a person and you're expecting them to be a mature person to respond and say, yeah, I got that part wrong myself. That was both of us. Most of the time, they will not immediately do it because you've literally thrown a wrench in the gears. This doesn't make sense. There has to be another shoe coming. This is going to have to be but you at some point. And when you don't do it, and you also, when you apologize, this is something we have to teach the kids. Just because you apologize does not mean the other party needs to instantly forgive you or even accept your apology at that moment. You let them go. Inevitably, unless they're just a shitty person you're better off with not in your life, they are going to think about it. They're going to realize that none of your baggage came along with it. And they're going to think, was I wrong? And if they were, they're probably going to see it. And they're going to come back and say, you know, yesterday, last an hour ago, 2 weeks ago, whatever, when you apologized for this thing, yeah, I was wrong too, and this is how. And it might take time for that person to be able to do it, but if we train this into our children, then we are building forthright, upstanding young adults. And that's what I want to end with. You are not, as a parent, raising children. If you are raising children, you're doing it wrong. Parents don't raise children if they're doing their job right. They raise adults. They raise adults. Because at some point in that process, the child begins to fade and the adult begins to rise. And you should be cognizant of that when you're teaching a three-year-old not to shit in their pants anymore. You should be cognizant of that when you're teaching an eight-year-old how to make a plant into a cutting that will root. You should be cognizant of that when you're having a conversation with a willful 13-year-old who doesn't get why what you're trying to get them to do is important. That my job here is to raise an adult, not a child. And I'm going to tell you, it is what we're doing. It's why we have 25 and 35-year-old people that say they're adulting because they did the fucking laundry for the first time in their life by themselves. That's why we have that. Because we're literally doing what people say, raising children. And this is something we have to start being mindful of. We have got to start being mindful of the power of words. When we say a thing, especially over time, and we repeat it, we cause it to come into existence. And I'm not talking about manifesting a parking spot or some stupid shit that some New Age book says you can do that you can't. Okay? I'm talking about real world consequences. When we say, I'm raising kids, and we say it all the time, we program ourselves to think of our children as kids. When we say, my job is to raise my children into adults, or to raise young adults, to bring them up so they can be outstanding young adults, then we act that way. Ask a teacher, well, what do? I teach children. Why do you think they act like children, even when they're grown? Why do we have 24, 25-year-old kids that are basically adult adolescents? Because our entire philosophy has come from that standpoint. Love that. Said it many times, Jesse. Train myself out of a job. That's exactly what you're doing as a parent when you do it right. You're obliterating your own job. You're training your replacement in one way or another because you're going to become granddad or grandma someday and they're going to be dad or mom. You're training your replacement. If you love the grandkids that you will someday have even before they're born, then you'll take what I ended here with to heart. Because you're training the parent of your grandchild when you're training and teaching your child. And we need to get into seventh generational thinking like I talk about all the time. But a good start for a lot of America would be at least to start thinking three generations when that second generation comes along for you. And again, I want to also encourage you that you can do this. Because some of you know enough about my life to know I did not have a wonderful childhood. I really didn't. And that's okay. But if I can do it, then you can too. Because we do model our behavior, but we have the choice as adults. When we say, look, I have shitty modeling, so I'm going to go find me some new models. I'm going to find my own leaders. In fact, selecting leaders is something we should teach. Maybe I'll get that into a future episode. That we should look for the people that do model the behavior that we truly admire and try to be more like them. Just a simple thing from a redneck hippie duck farmer. And I'll fully end with the current system will only change if it's literally starved to death. That is how you kill a parasite, is you deny them access to the host. And I don't give a shit who it offends at this point. I've explained myself enough on this issue. I don't care how much you love to teach or you believe in what you're doing. It is a system. It is a system that was designed in the 1800s, and it's changed very little ever since from the macro level of what the goal is. And it is a system that was built so that people would be just smart enough to work on an assembly line, but just dumb enough not to ask questions about why they're doing it. And then some percentage of those people would be like management quality or university quality. That's what it was. And now we've changed it. We're still doing the same macro, but everybody's supposed to be management quality, and not everybody wants to be management, right? And what I mean by that is top professionals across all disciplines. Anyway, I did have a couple questions, only two. I think one you're not going to like my response of. Jesse said, question statement, could gain experience with high stress first aid CPR emergencies as a volunteer at local fire department? Maybe, but probably not. Because you're going to have to do anything like that, really, you're going to have at least an EMT certification. But by the way, that's not that hard to do. And that, if you want to take like that level of, you know, care for trauma and things to another level, EMT certification would be something to pursue. I didn't do it. I didn't even know it was available. But in my high school, you were actually able to become an EMT in school and then do ride-alongs with ambulances. Because one of my friends, a guy named Brian Murray, who was like, this dude was huge. This dude, I remember one time he bought, like, he got his new pair of shoes. And I'm like, man, those are nice shoes. He goes, yeah, there were four pair at the store. I bought them all. And I'm like, why would you buy four pair of the same shoes? He's like, because when you wear a size 14 shoe and you find them, you buy them. Right. This guy was huge. But yeah, he ended up becoming an EMT while we were in high school. So that might be worth pursuing. Now, Builder of Castles is talking about this theta thing. And I'm not going to say too much about it because I don't know what it is exactly. But I smell shitcoin here. He says theta is a coin and protocol for sharing things like videos on the Internet. You get paid for hosting parts of the videos. I might actually be aware of that, and it might actually be something that works with Bitcoin. But if it isn't, we don't have a use case anymore for anything else. Like, we don't need things like that don't need their own shitcoin. They really don't. But I think we talked about this before, and it's kind of like file sharing, like kind of like the LimeWire protocol applied to videos and stuff. But I don't see why that can't run on Lightning. And maybe Theta is something being built on Lightning or Fediments or something like that. If that's the case, then I get it, right? So like Bitcoin in another form. But that would be the way to do it. Why, when you have the gold standard for hard money, then why in the world would you, if it will work, why would you use anything else? And I just think that there's a lot of these, you know, use cases that I even fell for myself in the past. But in my opinion now, like, I was wrong. Like, there was no need. Like, the idea of, I think it was called Sentinel. That was basically like VPNs, but basically you're selling your IP to other people to use it. And then Sentinel would be the currency that it's completely destroyed itself at this point. It's worthless. They made too many of them, and as the temptation will always be to turn the printer on if you can. And so we don't need that. If you wanted to do a decentralized VPN system, Lightning is perfect for it because it can literally be sent in real time, right? So as the data is being used, the money's coming in fractions of a cent. And so maybe that's what Theta is. I want to see something like that built in the Noster universe where, like right now, I am streaming to Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, Odyssey, and Rumble. I would like to have like Noster, right? Like, and then it's streaming it into a protocol where anybody using any client capable of seeing it could see it. Using something like RMTP, at least as a start, would be great. And we already have tech that does stuff like this. We don't need another technology as far as a cryptocurrency to do it. We need somebody to put it together in a way that makes sense and will work for people. Otherwise, I just think you're marketing a shitcoin. And again, I won't say that that's what's going on here. I haven't seen any follow-up on Theta here from the person that asked me about it. I think it was Builder of Castles, so I'm not sure. I know that Builder is on Noster, and also maybe that's what it is. Maybe that's where I heard about it. Anyway, with that wrapped up, let's go ahead real quick and let you guys know about the item of the day today. So I have a new product from Vivor, put out a video on it today. It is a cool little thing. They're like $37. It's basically a little bench for working in the garden, or it flips over and you can kneel on it to work in the garden. Now, I have many times been out needing to like plant transplants or whatever. And, you know, my beds are about 2 foot tall. So you kneel down to do it and you end up with your knees just dirty as shit and all. And I was even thinking about getting a set of like those knee pads or whatever the construction workers use, like to lay carpet or whatever. And I saw this as being available as a product sample with Vivor's influencer program that I'm part of. And I'm like, yes, send me one. And so I was given this product, but I would buy it. I would buy it. In fact, I mentioned in my write-up, there's a larger one. I may buy one of those just to compare them because it's not a lot of money. And it's one of those things that just makes your life a little better. And this thing right here, I'll tell you what it – and somebody's saying this is for Westerners. Whatever. Get over your shit. Get over your bullshit. You want to kneel in the mud? Go ahead and kneel in the mud. What I like about it really, though, is the little bags that are on it to hold all your shit so that when you get up and you're like, where's my trowel? It's right there. But the other place that I see this being really useful, because this damn thing is comfortable, is fishing. I do a lot of walk-in fishing. I have a thing I call a carrying cart to carry all my shit with me. And mainly I do that because I'm going to be there a while, and I like to enjoy myself when I take some actual time off. But the other reason is I bring fish home that I need to keep alive. That's not sitting on ice in a cooler. So that involves, you know, a cooler for all my stuff that I, you know, have a beer when you're fishing or whatever. But also they need a large container that can hold water, which is very heavy, to bring back with me. So I have this cart that I've rigged up for fishing. This would be fantastic for fishing because you have those your pliers and whatever. Because what ends up happening, I know all of you guys that do this kind of fishing know what I'm talking about. What becomes your tabletop? What becomes your tabletop? Your cooler, right? And then you got to take everything off the cooler to open it and get something out like bait or something you're keeping cold. And so I think this would be great for fishing and I'm sure some other things, but fantastic in the garden. I don't know who this person is that has to cry about everything, but Nikos, I don't give a shit. You want to sit in the dirt, you want to squat, whatever, you go ahead and you do it. Some of us believe in comfort, especially when it's so easily acquired. Anyway, Vivor has some really cool stuff, guys. You definitely want to check them out. And remember, if you do that, go through my link. I've added a Vivor link to the T-Spaz page where all my product reviews are. Sometimes I'll be reviewing products off Amazon now, sometimes direct from Vivor. This product is available on Amazon at about the same price as buying direct. But if you use my link and buy it direct and my discount code, you get 5 points off. So it's still less, even though their retail price point is about the same. But you can order it either place. I have links to both places. Remember, when you shop online, if you start at tspaz.com, you help us out no matter what you eventually buy. And then real quick here at the end, I want to remind you again about Home Food Systems and the Bioreactor Composting Course. Everybody that's taken it has given us nothing but positive feedback on it. It's only $40. If you want to learn how to make the best compost in the world with the least amount of work and to actually understand why it works and why it's so good, give this course a shot. I just got the numbers in for last week. We were still selling as much as we did from the launch. I wasn't sure that was going to happen. Like, you know, usually when you launch something like this, you get a big hit in the beginning and it wanes off and then you just sell one or two here and there. People are still taking this course like crazy and all the feedback's been positive. And trust me, if it wasn't, I would have heard about it. And, you know, if somebody wants their money back on anything I sell, if it's doable and certainly a non-physical product is doable, I give the money back. I give the money back because I just think that's the better way to do business. I don't want unhappy customers. Every second I spend trying to make an unhappy customer happy, I don't spend keeping happy customers happy. And the happy people are the people that I want. Fortunately, everybody seems pretty happy with it. So homefoodsystems.com and MSB members, you do get $5 off your course. I am just about ready to start recording for the cover crop and soils course that will be coming next. I'm getting a lot of questions about the aquaculture class. That was too big of a thing to bite off in one go. I'm going in this order. I'm going compost. I did the permaculture principles course, which is available there for free, and it will always be free. I've decided I'm never going to charge for that course. And then I'm going to have the soils and cover crop course, and then the biochar course. And that's because I think it'll help the most people as a core foundation of new knowledge. Then we are going to start doing the aquaculture course, but it will be like a beginner, intermediate, and advanced thing. It's just too huge of a subject to do in a single course. It really is. So that's how we'll approach that. But I'm trying to provide an education that helps the most people in the most situations. And most people aren't going to do aquaculture. Most people will do a garden. So if you know how to make great compost, you know how to make biochar, and you know how to effectively use cover crops and take care of soil, you will always be able to feed yourself. That's why we're making it the core. Thank you, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with another episode. Are they going to bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. Show you a better way.